from spiritual and emotional abuse and addiction to food, which is getting much better, and work, which is not, and control issues, which is why we're in this study. It's all about me. And I've had issues with pornography, alcohol, rage, panic, and depression. So I got to looking at this title today. I really apologize for my froggy voice, but I really feel much better than I sound. So I looked at this title today, and the title of the lesson is Patterns in Chaos. If you have patterns, then it shouldn't be chaotic. It should be organized, but patterns in chaos. And the lesson that we are looking at this week in our midweek groups on panic or control freaks is just about the whole idea of chaos. And the idea that our attempts to control things actually doesn't produce order. It produces chaos. It produces emotional chaos, relational chaos, because we're not really designed to be in control. That's not our strong suit. So the idea that we try harder, we obsess over things, it really causes us to lose. Well, it just exhausts us, for one. And for another, it causes us to lose focus and perspective. And something that Karen shared when she was up here a few weeks back, and that there are a lot of things we work at in life to make life better, and we really miss out on the goodness of life. I forget exactly what that quote was, but I work so hard to be better that I rob myself of the ability to be whole and healthy. So I'm working so hard at controlling my life and so hard at making order and patterns here that I miss out on the rest of life. There are relationships to be had, conversations to be enjoyed, just sunrises, sunsets, things like that that we just miss out on because we're so preoccupied with trying to maintain some sort of order and control. So what's sad about that is that being in recovery and looking back, I realized that it wasn't just me that I was affecting, that the others in my life were caught in the vortex of this craziness. Everybody knows what the vortex is behind a jet's wings, you know. And I think about the people that I left confused, frustrated, hurt, disappointed, you name it, because of my attempts to manhandle and control. And, you know, I've made amends the best I could, but, I mean, the only person who has to routinely put up with it now is my wife. Bless her heart. She gets caught up in the chaotic vortex. She made me a hot toddy yesterday for my, man, those things are good. So that might get me out of my, never mind. That gets into another issue. I didn't say any of that. And I don't know if this is about you or not, but I've watched patterns of people for a long time. I'm a people watcher, not so I can critique or judge, but just out of curiosity. I love to watch people. I love to go to airports. I love to go to malls. I love to go to places where you can just kind of watch people do what they do. And I like to watch people long-term, like here at Pathway, on staff here at church, just people that I can, my neighbors. I don't spy on my neighbors. I just kind of watch them, you know, just for fun. Shits and giggles, it was just for fun. But I've noticed that a lot of people, to maintain control, are really addicted to routines. Have you ever noticed that? No, now's not the time to drink coffee. You have to do this first. Then you drink your coffee. Then you read the and then you talk the, and then you let the dog out. And then you, it's got to be, and routines are so, so important. If you think you're not addicted to routines, try changing them. I've always said that if you think it, you don't think the church you're going to is a cult, try leaving it. Or if you think the religious persuasion you're part of is not a cult, try disagreeing with it or asking questions. You know, just try it and see what happens. If you think you're not addicted to routine, try changing them. Just think about that. So I've had to write some of mine down, and then some of these may apply to you. Try not turning on the computer in the morning. Try not watching TV after supper. Try not calling the same person every day or texting the same person. Try not stopping by your boss's office every morning. Try not driving past the same liquor store every night. Try not reading the same author over and over and over, or the same scholar, whatever. Try not watching the same news station over and over and over. I mean, you could just add to that list. What would happen if you just completely switched for a while, just for fun, just completely switched? And control freaks hate change. We hate change. And if you want to scare me, start talking about changing some of my routines. If you want to throw me into a tailspin, talk about this next week, it's going to go down this way. No, that's not the way my weeks go down. My weeks go down this way. I've got a little calendar. I keep it all orderly. No, it's not going down that way. This is the way it's going down. So this one kind of scared me because I thought, what if I tried some of that? Change some of my routines and see what would... Because we hide in our routines. And we can avoid, I can't talk to you right now. I'm involved in this. No, I can't come to your party, your gathering, because I always do this on Thursday nights and blah, blah, blah. You know, and our routines get us out of a lot of encounters that we could otherwise have. So what if we changed some of them and said, yeah, I usually do this, but you know what? Instead, I'm going to sit down with a Coke with so-and-so or sit down with a cup of coffee with so-and-so. And I don't know. Just whatever. You can control routines. You can't control conversations. You can't control relationships. So, yeah. I think this study has really blindsided me because I thought I was no longer a control freak. This is embarrassing. I mean, I'm a control freak. Still, after all these years of recovery. And this study really bothers me. And then I'll read the lesson. I wrote the freaking stuff. I'll read the lesson. And I'll think, okay, I don't have a problem there. And I'll get to the questions. And I'm doing four studies now. Monday afternoon, Monday night, Thursday at noon, and Thursday night. And those questions are raking me over the coals. They're just like, I didn't think I was a control freak, but I am. And so I'm realizing that one of the best remedies for being a control freak is to become much more of a people person and much less of a routine person. Because people are messy. Relationships are messy. And you want to mess with your control addiction. Stick in people. Just stick in people. And they will, guaranteed, they will mess you up, which is, I think, a very good thing. I don't think we need to fill our lives with toxic people, but I think we need some. I really do. I think we need a few toxic people, but I think we need people in our life. So, and here's the third thing, and we got four things, so here's the third thing. I think that, and I mentioned something about this maybe four lessons ago, but I thought it would be good to come back on this. I actually learned this from my dad. I remember us having a conversation about this years ago, and I thought, oh, that makes a lot of sense. When we think about personal change, when we think about, okay, I don't want to be a control freak. I want to be more free. I want to be free to be who I am and let other people be who they are, because that's the opposite of being a control freak. I can't manage all the situations, all the conversations, all the people. I can't do that. So I want to change. And he said, you have to really think about the difference between these two words. Do you want a quantitative change or do you want a qualitative change? I remember that conversation. I thought, crap, there's a lot right there. Because a quantitative change means I still do unhealthy, messed up things, but I don't do them as much. So I've cut back on it. This is a drastically terrible example. But you have a little grandchild or a little child. They just want a pinch of rat poison. Just a pinch. Just a pinch. Not a whole big dose. Just a pinch. Are you good with that? I mean, that's a drastic example. But I think, why do we think that we're healthy if we quantitatively make changes? We don't do that as much as we were doing it. The want to's still there. The addiction, maybe it's not addiction, but the want to's still there. So what I want is I want to live with God in such a way, and God, I want to invite God into my life in such a way that I don't just have quantitative change, but qualitative change. That I don't just do unhealthy things less. I'm living a more healthy life. I'm pursuing a more healthy life. I just wrote down several sentences right over top of each other. I work at my behavior management. That's quantitative. I don't do as many bad things as I used to. I manage my behavior. I'm still in control. See? Or I surrender to God who changes my heart. Here's another way to put it. I curb my appetites. Don't eat as much. Don't gamble as much. Don't drink as much. Don't, whatever you want to say. I curb my appetites. God changes my appetite. See the difference between quantitative and qualitative? I go through the motions. God transforms my motives. So it's a little sideline here. It is so cool to have made peace with my Father. Now, all these good conversations I had with him are coming back to me. I'm remembering these. I'm thinking, shoot, he could be a booger, but my dad had a lot of wisdom. A lot of wisdom. And we had some deep, good talks. When times were good, they were very good. When they were bad, they were very bad. But so this thing about qualitative versus quantitative. So I'm asking myself, whenever we get to the end of a lesson like this, if anybody comes up and talks afterwards, a lot of times the comments go to, okay, what you said made a lot of sense. How do we make that happen? What you said, and Wayne and I talked about this a lot, and that we would give the good philosophical, theological foundation, and everybody would say, okay, it sounds great. How do you do that? You know, give me some practical, you know, ways of doing this. And this is not practical in terms of take the number two bolt and screw it into the number two nut and put it, you know, it's not that mechanical, but it is it's more practical than just theory. I think it comes down to simply hanging out with God, living with God, living as if God is present 24/7, even in the bad times. But right now I'm full of pride. God's still here. Right now I'm full of lust. God's still here. Right now I'm telling a little white lie. God's still here. Right now I'm really, really angry at my neighbor. I wish, you know, bad things would happen to him. God is still right here. It takes a while to wrap your mind around the fact that God doesn't leave the room when we're having a bad day. God doesn't say, well, I'm out of here because you're in a bitchy mood or because you're having hateful thoughts or self-destructive thoughts or whatever. God doesn't leave the room. God is here for the duration. He is the one who walks alongside of us. The paraclete, the one who walks alongside. It's what Jesus promised. And so, my old paradigm used to be, and I'm done with this, my old paradigm used to be that, you know, we would sing the song, I Surrender All, I Surrender All. We'd sing that at the end of a service. And the idea was, I need to be a puddle of nothingness at the feet of God. I need to melt down to nothing. I need to just, almost in a self-destruct. And that's what surrender looks like. It looks like total and absolute capitulation. And I thought that, I taught it, and I preached it for years. I don't believe that anymore. I'm just not there anymore. I think surrendering to God is not capitulation. I think surrendering to God is cooperation. And the reason I say that is because at the very beginning of the story and at the very end of the story we call Scripture. At the very beginning, we say God's showing up and saying, do you want to take a walk? I don't want you to walk behind me because I'm God and you're human. And I don't want you to walk out front so I can boss you around and tell you where to go. I want to walk with you. I want you to be my friend, and I want to walk with you. And we'll talk about whatever we want to talk about. This is not stepping into the confessional booth with the priest. It's not about bitching and moaning about that spouse you gave me. It's not about an organ recital. Well, this organ hurts and that organ hurts. And, you know, you didn't make us very well. You didn't design us very well. I think they got together and just talked about whatever they talked about. They did life together every day. He'd show up and they did life together and talked about apples and oranges and funny animals with long noses, and they just enjoyed being together. And Jesus said to his disciples in John, it's better that I go away, because if I do, I'm going to send the paraclete, the comforter, your partner, who will walk with you, walk alongside you. I want to go back to the garden. I don't want you to capitulate to me. I want you to cooperate with me. I want to walk together with you. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what that looks like. Okay, so think about this. I have control over capitulation, right? Think about that. I have, because I'm saying to capitulate would mean I'd stop doing this, stop doing that, start doing this, start doing this. I'd keep track of that. I'd do that much longer, pray much longer than I used to. I'd read the Bible much. So capitulation is something I keep track of and I manage for the most part. Does that make sense? Because we usually set, isn't that weird? We usually set the terms of our own surrender. If I surrender to God, it's going to look like this. It's probably going to resemble what we've been taught by our church of origin or by our parents. This is what surrender looks like. This is what capitulation looks like. If it switches from capitulation to cooperation, it's like, I don't have a clue what that looks like. I don't know what it looks like. What Wayne came up with, I don't know, 10 years ago, and he and I said it over and over. God is at work in everybody all the time. When we meet with them, we watch for what God is doing, and when we can, we participate in it. What's that going to look like? I don't know. I don't know who the person is. I don't know what they're going through. I don't know what God's doing. So I have to wait till I get there. That also it applies to the person in the mirror. So you get up in the morning, you're brushing your teeth, shaving your face, not you women, if you do, bless you. You're shaving your face, whatever, combing your hair, and you're looking in the mirror, you're saying, what is God doing in this person's life today? And I want to participate in it. I want to cooperate in that. So it's different every day. It's different with every person. Your moods change, their moods change. Your phase in life changes. You go from being young, to being middle-aged, to being older. Hey, Rick, we're the old ones. So everything is shifting. Everything is changing. And I think that's good. Because the more it shifts and the more it changes, the less control we have and the more we realize, I could do this. I could live without micromanaging my life. I can live without being in control because I'm doing this with a partner who loves me, and it's as big an adventure for him as it is for me right now. So let's just enjoy and see where this goes. I don't know if this is helpful to y'all. Somewhere back in my ministry, I decided that I could. Do you know what the lectionary is? It's a thing that some churches use where every Sunday they tell you what you're supposed to preach. They'll give you an Old Testament passage, a gospel passage, and an epistle passage. And they'll tell you, and you go through that. Some preachers preach that, and I thought, I can't do that. I can't do that. That's prescribed. That's written by somebody far away, decided by somebody far away. That doesn't always apply here. Then I started to kind of preach or teach according to what I saw in the group, which was kind of a cheap shot because I should have been having personal conversations, not lobbing mortars in from the pulpit. So it's gotten to me now where I think I'm struggling, I'm discovering, and when I look around, I see other people struggling with the same thing. So I'm just going to share where I'm at, you know? So more and more when I teach, it's more of a testimony than a lesson. It's more of just my own shit that's coming, you know, that I'm discovering and learning. And that's what that book's about, 40 Days of Grace. That's just Wayne and I struggling through hard things and making some discoveries and then just writing down this what we discovered. I don't know if that's good or not, but that's why I'm going to be doing it. Talking back.